101. It was a long time before Peter could put his whirling thoughts in order. His mind kept circling back to one question. What had Dennis seen to change his mind so radically and completely? What, in the names of all the gods, could it have been? Little by little he came to realize that it didn't matter. Dennis had seen something, and that was enough. Pena. Dennis had gone to Pena, and Pena had sensed. Well, the old fox had sensed something.
He thinks you may have some sort of plan, but what he knows not.
Old fox, indeed. He had not forgotten Peter's request for the dollhouse and the napkins. He hadn't known exactly what those things meant, but he had sensed something in the wind. Aye, well and truly. Then what was Peter to do? Part of him, a very large part, wanted to go ahead just as he had planned. He had worked his courage up to this desperate adventure. Now it was hard to let it go for nothing but more waiting. And there were the dreams, urging him on as well.
You would know the name of this black killer if I dared to write it, but I do not.
Peter knew just the same, of course, and it was that, more than anything else, that convinced him Dennis really had stumbled onto something. Peter felt that Flagg might soon awake to this new development, and he wanted to be gone before that happened.
Was a day too long to wait?
Perhaps. Perhaps not. Peter was torn in an agony of indecision. Ben. Thomas. Flagg. Pena. Dennis. They whirled in his brain like figures seen in a dream. What should he do? In the end, it was the appearance of the note itself, not what was in it, that persuaded him. For it to come this way, pinned to a napkin on the very night he meant to try his rope made of napkins, it meant he should wait, but only for a night. Ben would not be able to help.
Could Dennis help him, though? What could he do?
And suddenly, in a flash of light, an idea came to him. Peter had been sitting on his bed, hunched over the note, his brows furrowed. Now he straightened up, his eyes alight. His eyes fell on the note again.
If you have something on which you can write, then throw down a note and I will try to retrieve it late this night.
Yes, of course he had something to write on. Not the napkin itself, because it might be missed. Not Dennis's note either, because it was written on both sides from side to side and top to bottom. But Valera's parchment was not. Peter went back into his sitting room. He glanced at the door and saw that the spy hole was closed. Dimly he could hear the warders at cards below. He crossed to the window and waved twice, hoping that Dennis was really out there somewhere and could see him. He would just have to hope so. Peter went back to the bedroom, pulled up the loose stone, and after some reaching and fumbling, retrieved the locket and the parchment. He turned the parchment over to the blank side. But what was he to do for ink? After a moment the answer came to him. The same thing Valera had done, of course. Peter worked at his thin straw mattress, and after some tugging opened a seam. The stuffing was of straw, and before long he had found a number of good long stalks that would serve as pens. Then he opened the locket. It was in the shape of a heart, and the point at the bottom was sharp. Peter closed his eyes for a moment and said a brief prayer. Then he opened them and drew the point of the locket across his wrist. Blood swelled up at once, much more than had come from the pinprick earlier. He dipped the first straw in his blood and began to write. 102. Standing in the cold darkness across the plaza, Dennis saw Peter's shape come to the small window at the top of the needle. He saw Peter raise his arms over his head and cross them twice. There would be a message then. It doubled, no, trebled his risk. But he was glad. He settled in to wait, feeling numbness slowly creep over his feet and kill the feeling in them. The wait seemed very long. The crier called 10, then 11, finally 12 of the clock. The clouds had hidden the moon, but the air seemed strangely light, another sign of a coming storm. He was beginning to think that Peter must have forgotten him, or changed his mind, when that shape came to the window again. Dennis straightened up, wincing at the pain in his neck, which had been cocked upward for the last 4 hours. He thought he saw something arc out, and then Peter's shape left the high window. A moment later, the light up there was extinguished. Dennis looked left and right, saw no one, took all of his courage in his hands and ran out into the plaza. He knew perfectly well that there might be someone, a more alert guard of the watch than last night's tuneless singer, for instance, whom he hadn't seen, but there was nothing to be done about that. He was also gruesomely aware of all the men and women who had been beheaded not far from here. What if their ghosts were still around lurking? But thinking about such things did no good, and so he tried to put them from his mind. Of more immediate concern was just finding the thing that Peter had thrown. The area at the foot of the needle below Peter's window was a featureless white snowfield. Feeling horribly exposed, Dennis began to cast about like an inept hunting dog. He wasn't sure what he had seen glimmering in the air. It had been there only for a second, but it had looked solid. That made sense. Peter would not have thrown a piece of paper which might have fluttered anywhere. But what, and where was it? As the seconds ticked by, turning into minutes, Dennis began to feel more and more frantic. He dropped to his hands and knees and began to crawl about, peering into footprints which had melted to the size of dragon prints earlier that day, and which were now refreezing, hard and blue and shiny. Sweat coursed down his face, and he began to be deviled by a recurring idea that a hand would fall on his shoulder, and when he turned he would see the grinning face of the king's magician inside his dark cowl.
A little late for hide and seek, isn't it, Dennis?
Flagg would say, and although his grin would widen, his eyes would burn a baleful, hellish red.
What have you lost? Can I help you find it?
Don't think his name. For the gods' sake, don't think his name. But it was hard to stop. Where was it? Oh, where was it? Back and forth Dennis crawled, his hands now as numb as his feet. Back and forth, back and forth. Where was it? Bad enough if he was unable to find it. Worse still if the snow held off until morning light and someone else did. Gods knew what it might say. Dimly, he heard the crier call 1 o'clock. He was now covering ground he had already covered before, becoming more and more panicky.
Stop, Dennis. Stop, boy.
His da's voice too clear in his head to be mistaken. Dennis had been on his hands and knees, his nose almost on the ground. Now he straightened up a little.
You're not seeing anything anymore, boy. Stop and close your eyes for a moment, and when you open them, look around. Really look around.
Dennis closed his eyes tight, and then opened them wide. This time he looked around almost casually, scanning the whole snowy tract area around the foot of the needle. Nothing. Nothing at—
Wait! There! Over there!
Something glimmered. Dennis saw a curve of metal, barely poking half an inch out of the snow. Beside it, he could see a round track made by one of his knees. He had almost crawled over the thing during his frantic hunt. He tried to pluck it from the snow, and on his first try only pushed it farther in. His hand was almost too numb to close. Digging in the snow for the metal object, Dennis realized that if his knee had come down on it instead of beside it, he would have driven it more deeply into the snow without even feeling it. His knees were as numb as the rest of him, and then he never would have seen it at all. It would have remained buried until the spring thaws. He touched it, forced his fingers to close, and brought it out. He looked at it wonderingly. It was a locket which might be gold, in the shape of a heart. There was a fine chain attached to it. The locket was shut, but caught in its jaws was a folded piece of paper. Very old paper. Dennis pulled the note free, closed his hand gently over the old paper, and slipped the locket's chain over his head. He got creakily to his feet and ran back toward the shadows. That run was, in a way, the worst part of the whole business for him. He had never felt so exposed in his whole life. For every step he ran, the comforting shadows of the buildings on the far side of the plaza seemed to recede a step. At last he reached comparative safety and stood in the shadows for a while, panting and shuddering. When he had gotten his breath, he returned to the castle, slinking along the fourth alley in the shadows and entering by Cook's Way. There was a guard of the watch at the doorway leading into the castle proper, but he was as sloppy about his duties as his mate had been the night before. Dennis waited, and eventually the guard wandered off. Dennis darted inside. 20 minutes later, he was safely back in the storeroom of the Napkins. Here he unfolded the note and looked at it. One side was closely writ in an archaic hand. The writer had used a strange, rust-colored ink, and Dennis could make nothing of it. He turned the note over and his eyes widened. He recognized the ink that had been used to write the short message on this side easily enough.
"Oh, King Peter," he moaned.
The message was smeared and blurry. The ink had not been blotted, but he could read it.
"Meant to try escape tonight. We'll wait one night. Dare wait no longer. Don't go for Ben. No time. Too dangerous. I have a rope. Thin. May break. Too short. Will be a drop in any case. 20 feet. Midnight tomorrow. Help me away if you can. Safe place. May be hurt. In the hands of the gods. I love you, my good Dennis. King Peter."
Dennis read this note 3 times and then burst into tears. Tears of joy. That light Pena had sensed was now shining brightly in Dennis's own heart. That was well, and soon all would be well. His eyes returned again and again to the line, "I love you, my good Dennis," written in the king's own blood. He had not needed to add that for the message to make sense, and yet he had.
"Peter, I would die 1,000 deaths for you," Dennis thought.
He put the note inside his jerkin and lay down with the locket still around his neck. It was a very long time before sleep found him this time, and he had not slept long before he snapped wide awake. The door of the storeroom was opening. The low creak of its hinges seemed an inhuman shriek to Dennis. Before his sleep-fuddled mind even had time to realize he had been found, a dark shadow with burning eyes swept down on him. 103. The snow began at around 3 o'clock that Monday morning. Ben Stodd saw the first flakes go skating past his eyes as he and Naomi stood at the edge of the king's preserves, looking out toward the castle. Frisky sat on her haunches, panting. The humans were tired, and Frisky was tired as well, but she was eager to go. The scent had grown steadily fresher. She had led them easily from Pena's farm to the deserted house where Dennis had spent some 4 days, eating raw potatoes and thinking sour thoughts about turnips, which turned out to be as sour as the thoughts themselves. In that empty inner barony's farmstead, the bright blue scent she had followed this far had been everywhere. She had barked excitedly, running from room to room, nose down, tail wagging cheerfully.
"Look," Naomi said, "our Dennis burnt something here."
She was pointing at the fireplace. Ben came and looked, but he could make out nothing. There were only bundles of ash which fell apart when he poked at them. Of course they were Dennis's early tries at his note.
"Now what?" Naomi asked. "He went to the castle from here, that's clear. The question is, do we follow or spend the night here?"
It had then been 6 o'clock. Outside it was already dark.
"I think we had better go on," Ben said slowly. "After all, it was you who said we wanted Frisky's nose, not her eyes. And I, for one, would testify before the throne of any king in creation that Frisky has a noble nose."
Frisky, sitting in the doorway, barked as if to say she knew it.
"All right," Naomi said.
He looked at her closely. It had been a long run from the camp of the exiles, with little rest for either of them. He knew they should stay, but he was nearly frantic with urgency.
"Can you go on?" he asked. "Don't say you can if you can't, Naomi Rachel."
She put her hands on her hips and looked at him haughtily.
"I could go on 100 kroner from the place where you dropped dead, Ben Stodd."
Ben grinned. "You may get your chance to prove it too," he said. "But first we'll have a bite to eat." They ate quickly. When the meal was finished, Naomi knelt by Frisky and quietly told her that she must take up the scent again. Frisky didn't have to be asked twice. The three of them quit the farmhouse, Ben with a large pack on his back, Naomi with one only slightly smaller. To Frisky, Dennis's scent was a blue mark in the night, as bright as a wire glowing with an electric charge. She began to follow at once, and was confused when the girl called her back. Then it came to her. If Frisky had been human, she would have slapped her forehead and groaned. In her impatience to be off, she had started sniffing up Dennis's back trail. By midnight, she would have had them back at Pena's farmhouse.
"That's all right, Frisky," Naomi said. "Take your time."
"Sure," Ben said. "Take a week or two, Frisky. Take a month if you want."
Naomi cast a sour glance Ben's way. Ben shut up. Prudently, perhaps. The two of them watched Frisky nose back and forth, first across the dooryard of the deserted farm, then across the road.
"Has she lost it?" Ben asked.
"No, she'll pick it up in a minute or two."
"I think," Naomi didn't say aloud.
"It's just that she's found a whole tangle of scents in the road and she has to sort them out."
"Look," Ben said doubtfully, "she's off into the field there. That can't be right, can it?"
"I don't know. Would he have taken the road to the castle?"
Ben Stott was human, and he did slap his forehead.
"No, of course not. I'm a dolt."
Naomi smiled sweetly and said nothing. In the field, Frisky had paused. She turned toward the girl and the tall boy and barked impatiently for them to follow. Anduin huskies were the tame descendants of the great white wolves the residents of the northern barony had feared in earlier times, but tame or not, they were hunters and trackers before they were anything else. Frisky had isolated that bright blue thread of scent again and was in a fever to be off.
"Come on," Ben said. "I just hope she's found the right scent."
"Of course she has, look."
She pointed, and Ben was just able to make out long, shallow tracks in the snow. Even in the dark, Ben and Naomi knew the tracks for what they were, snowshoes. Frisky barked again.
"Let's hurry," Ben said.
By midnight, as they began to draw close to the king's preserves, Naomi began to regret the crack she'd made about how she could go on 100 kroner from the place where Ben dropped dead, because she had begun to feel as if that might soon happen to her. Dennis had made the trip in better time, but Dennis had set out after 4 days of rest. Dennis had had snowshoes, and Dennis had not been following a dog who sometimes lost the scent and had to cast about for it again. Naomi's legs felt hot and rubbery. Her lungs burned. There was a stitch in her left side. She had taken a few mouthfuls of snow, but they could not slake her raging thirst. Frisky, who was not burdened by a pack and who could run lightly along the snow crust, was not tired at all. Naomi was able to walk on the crust for short distances, but then she would strike a rotten spot and plunge through the crust into soft snow up to her knees, and on several occasions up to her hips. Once she plunged in waist-deep and floundered about in a tired fury until Ben worked his way over and pulled her out.
"Wish... sled," she panted now.
"Wishes, horses, beggars would ride," he panted back, grinning in spite of his own weariness.
"Funny,"
she gasped.
"Ha ha, ought to be a court jester, Benstad."
"King's preserves up there, less snow, easier."
He bent over, hands on his knees, and gasped for breath. Naomi suddenly felt that she had been selfish and unkind, thinking about how she herself felt when Ben must be even closer to the point of exhaustion. He was much heavier than she, especially with the weight of the larger pack he carried added into the bargain. He had been breaking through the snow crust on almost every step, leaping through the long fields like a man running in deep water, and yet he had not complained or slowed.
"Ben, are you all right?"
"No," he wheezed and grinned, "but I'll make it, pretty child."
"I am not a child,"
she said angrily.
"But you are pretty," he said, and put his thumb to the tip of his nose. He wiggled his fingers at her.
"Oh, I'll get you for that."
"Later," he panted. "Race you to the woods, come on."
So they raced, with Frisky chasing along the scent ahead of them, and he beat her, and that made her madder than ever. But she admired him, too. 104. Now they stood looking across the 70 kroner of open ground, between the edge of the forest where King Roland had once slain a dragon, and the walls of the castle where he had been slain himself. A few more snowflakes skirled down from the sky, and a few more, and suddenly, magically, the air was filled with snow. In spite of his weariness, Ben felt a moment of peace and joy. He looked at Naomi and smiled. She tried a scowl, but it wouldn't fit her face, and so she smiled too. A moment later, she ran her tongue out and tried to catch a flake of snow. Ben laughed quietly.
"How did he get inside if he did?"
Naomi asked.
"I don't know," Ben said.
He had grown up on a farm and knew nothing of the castle's sewer system. Probably every bit as well for him, you might say, and you would be right. Perhaps your champion dog can show us how he did it.
"You really think he did, don't you, Ben?"
"Oh, aye," Ben said. "What do you think, Frisky?"
At the sound of her name, Frisky got up, ranged along the scent for a few feet, and looked back at them. Naomi looked at Ben. Ben shook his head.
"Not yet," he said.
Naomi called Frisky softly, and she came back whining.
If she could talk, she'd tell you she's afraid of losing the scent. The snow will cover it.
We'll not wait long. Dennis had the snowshoes, but we're going to have something he didn't, Naomi.
What's that?
Cover. 105. In spite of Frisky's growing restlessness at being checked on the scent, Ben made them wait 15 minutes. By then the air had become a shifting cloud of white. Snow frosted Naomi's brown hair and his own blonde hair. Frisky wore a cold ermine stole. They could no longer see the castle walls ahead of them.
All right, Ben said softly. Let's go.
They crossed the open ground behind Frisky. The big husky moved slowly now, her nose constantly at the snow, puffing it up every now and again in cold little bursts. The bright blue runner of scent was dimming, being covered by the white, no-smell stuff from the sky.
We may have waited too long, Naomi said quietly beside him.
Ben said nothing. He knew it, and the knowledge gnawed at his heart like a rat. Now a dark bulk loomed out of the whiteness, the castle wall. Naomi had moved slightly ahead. Ben reached out and grabbed her arm.
The moat, he said. Don't forget that. It's up here somewhere. You'll go over the side and land on the ice and break your neck.
He got just so far, and then Naomi's eyes blazed with alarm. She pulled out of his grip.
Frisky,
she hissed.
Hi, Frisky, danger, drop off.
She darted after the dog. That girl is absolutely giddy bonkers, Ben thought with a certain admiration. Then he darted after her. Naomi needn't have worried. Frisky had stopped at the edge of the moat. Her nose was buried in the snow and her tail was wagging happily. Now she bit down on something and dragged it out of the loose powder. She turned to Naomi, eyes asking, Now am I a good dog or what? What do you think? Naomi laughed and hugged her dog. Ben glanced toward the castle wall.
Hush,
he whispered at her.
If the guards hear you, we're in the slate cracker for sure. Where do you think we are? Your back garden.
Pooh! If they heard anything, they'd think it was snow sprites and run for their mommies.
But she whispered too. Then she buried her face in Frisky's fur and told her again what a good dog she was. Ben scratched Frisky's head. Because of the snow, neither of them had the horribly exposed sense Dennis had had when he had sat in the same place, taking off the snowshoes Frisky had now found.
Nose of the gods, all right, Ben said. But what happened after he took off the snowshoes, Frisky? Did he grow wings and fly over Western Redan? Where did he go from here?
As if in answer, Frisky broke away from both of them and went floundering and slipping down the steep bank to the frozen moat.
Frisky!
Naomi called, her voice low but alarmed. Frisky only stood on the ice looking up at them, hock deep in new snow. Her tail was wagging slightly and her eyes begged them to come. She did not bark. Somehow she knew better, even though Naomi had not thought to warn her to silence. But she barked in her mind. The scent was still here, and she wanted to follow it before it disappeared completely, as it now would within minutes. Naomi looked questioningly at Ben.
Yes,
he said.
Of course, we have to. Come on. But keep her to heel. Don't let her range ahead. There's danger here, I feel it.
He held out his hand. Naomi grasped it, and they slid down to the moat together. Frisky led them slowly across the ice toward the castle wall. She was now actually digging for the scent, her nose furrowing the snow. It had begun to be overlaid with a thick, unpleasant smell. Dirty, warm water, garbage, ordure. Dennis had known that the ice would begin to grow dangerously rotten as he got closer to the outflow pipe. Even if he hadn't known, he was able to see the 3 feet or so of open water next to the wall. Things weren't so easy for Ben, Naomi, and Frisky. They had simply assumed that if the ice was thick along the moat's outer bank, it must be thick all the way across, and their eyes were of little use to them in the thickly falling snow. Frisky's eyes were the weakest of the three, and she was in the lead. Her ears were sharp enough, and she had heard the ice groaning beneath the new snow, but the scent was too much on her mind for her to take much notice of the faint creaks, until the ice gave way beneath her and she plunged into the moat with a splash.
Frisky!
Ben clapped a hand over her mouth. She struggled to get away from him. Ben had now seen the danger, however, and held her fast. Naomi needn't have worried. Of course all dogs can swim, and with her thick, oily coat, Frisky was safer in the water than either of the humans would have been. She paddled almost to the castle wall amid chunks of rotted ice and whipped cream globs of snow that quickly turned into dark slush and disappeared. She raised her head, smelling, searching for the scent, and when she knew where it went, she turned and paddled back toward Ben and Naomi. She found the edge of the ice. Her paws broke it off, and she tried again. Naomi cried out.
"Be still, Naomi, or you'll have us in the dungeons by dawn," Ben said. "Hold my ankles."
He let her go and then sprawled on his belly. Naomi crouched behind him and seized his boots. This close to the ice, Ben could hear it groaning and muttering.
"It could have been one of us," he thought, "and that would have been trouble indeed."
He spread his legs out a bit to distribute his weight better, and then grabbed Frisky by the forepaws just below her wide, strong chest.
"Here you come, girl," Ben grunted. "I hope."
Then he pulled. For a moment, Ben thought that the ice would just go on breaking under Frisky's weight as he dragged her forward. First he and then Naomi would follow Frisky into the moat. Crossing that moat on his way into the castle to play with his friend Peter on a summer's day, with blue sky and white clouds reflecting off its surface, Ben had always thought it beautiful, like a painting. He had never once suspected that he might die in it one black night during a snowstorm, and it smelled very bad.
"Pull me backward," he grunted. "Your damn dog weighs a ton. Don't you say mean things about my dog, Ben's dad."
Ben's eyes were slitted shut with strain, his lips split open over clenched teeth.
"A million pardons, and if you don't start pulling me, I'm going to be taking a bath, I think."
Somehow she managed to do it, although Ben and Frisky together must have been three times her own weight. Ben's prone, splayed body dug a channel in the new powder, a snow pyramid built up in his crotch, the way it will build up in the angle of a wooden plow. At last. It seemed like at last to Ben and Naomi, although in truth it was probably only a matter of seconds. Frisky's chest stopped breaking the ice and slid onto it. A moment later, her rear paws were digging for purchase. Then she was up and shaking herself vigorously. Dirty moat water sprayed into Ben's face.
"Pah!"
he grimaced, wiping it off.
"Thanks a lot, Frisky."
But Frisky paid no attention. She was looking toward the wall of the castle again. Although the ice was already freezing to her pelt in dirty spicules, the scent was what interested her. She had smelled it clearly, above her but not far above her. There was a darkness there, no cold white, no-smell stuff there. Ben was getting to his feet, brushing the snow off.
"I'm sorry I yelled like that," Naomi whispered. "If it had been any other dog but Frisky, do you think I was heard?"
"If you'd been heard, we'd have been challenged," Ben whispered back.
"Gods, that was close."
Now they could see the open water just in front of the ancient stone wall of Castle Delane's outer redan, because they were looking for it.
"What do we do?"
"We can't go on," Ben whispered. "That's obvious."
"But what did he do, Naomi? Where did he go from here? Maybe he did fly." "If we..."
But Naomi never finished the thought, because that was when Frisky took matters into her own paws. All of her ancestors had been famous hunters, and it was in her blood. She had been set upon this exciting, enticing electric blue scent, and she found she could not leave it. So she screwed her haunches down to the ice, tensed her sled-toughened muscles, and leaped into the dark. Her eyes, as I've said, were the least of her sensory equipment, and her leap really was blind. She could not see the dark hole of the sewer pipe from the edge of the ice, but she had seen it from the water, and even if she hadn't, she had her nose, and she knew it was there. 106.
"It's Flag,"
Dennis's sleep-fuddled mind thought as that dark shape with the burning eyes swept down on him.
"It's Flag. He's found me, and now he'll rip my throat out with his teeth."
He tried to scream, but no sound came out. The mouth of the intruder did open. Dennis saw huge white teeth, and then a big warm tongue was lapping his face.
"Ugh!"
Dennis said, trying to push the thing away. Paws came up on either shoulder, and Dennis fell back on his mattress of napkins like a pinned wrestler. "Lap, lap, lick, lick."
"Ugh!"
Dennis said again, and the dark, shaggy shape uttered a low, companionable woof, as if to say, "I know it. I'm glad to see you, too."
"Frisky,"
a low voice called from the darkness.
"Stand down, Frisky. No sounds."
The dark shape was not Flag at all. It was an extremely large dog, a dog which looked too much like a wolf for comfort, Dennis thought. When the girl spoke, it drew away and sat down. It looked happily at Dennis. its tail thumped mutedly on Dennis's bed of napkins. Two more shapes in the darkness, one taller than the other. Not flag, that much was clear. Castle guards, then. Dennis grabbed his dagger. If the gods were good, he might be able to get rid of both of them. If not, then he would try to die well in the service of his king. The two figures had stopped a little short of him. "Come on!" Dennis said and raised his dagger. It was really not much more than a pocket knife and was rather rusty and quite dull, in a brave gesture. "First you two and then your devil dog!"
"Dennis?"
The voice was eerily familiar.
"Dennis, have we really found you?"
Dennis started to lower his dagger, then brought it up again. It had to be a trick. Had to be. But the voice sounded so much like...
"Ben,"
he whispered.
"Is it Ben Stodd?" "It's Ben,"
the taller shape confirmed, and gladness filled Dennis's heart. The shape began to come forward. Alarmed, Dennis raised his dagger again.
"Wait! Do you have a light?" "Flint and steel, yes." "Strike it!"
"Aye." A moment later, a big yellow spark, surely dangerous in that room filled with dry cotton napkins, flared in the gloom.
"Come forward, Ben,"
Dennis said, reseating his poor excuse for a dagger in its sheath. He got to his feet, trembling with gladness and relief.
Ben was here.
By what magic, Dennis did not know, only that it had somehow happened. His feet caught in the napkins and he stumbled forward, but there was no danger that he might fall, because Ben's arms swept him up in a strong embrace. Ben was here and all would be well, Dennis thought, and it was all he could do to keep from bursting into unmanly tears. 107. There followed a great exchange of stories. I think you have heard most of them, and the parts you haven't can be told quickly enough. Frisky's leap was a bullseye. She carried straight into the pipe and then turned around to see if Naomi and Ben would follow her. If they hadn't done so, Frisky would have eventually leaped back to the ice. She should have been greatly disappointed to do it, but she would not have left her mistress for the most exciting scent in the world. Frisky knew that. Naomi was less sure. She didn't even dare call Frisky back for fear of a guard's overhearing. She therefore intended to go after the dog. She would not leave Frisky, and if Ben tried to make her, she would deck him with a right hook. She needn't have worried. The minute he spotted the pipe, Ben understood where Dennis had gone.
"Noble knows Frisky,"
he said. He turned to Naomi.
"Can you make it?"
"If I draw back and run, I can make it."
"Don't misjudge where the ice goes rotten, or you'll take a donking, and your heavy clothes will drag you down very quickly."
"I won't misjudge."
"Let me go first," Ben said. "If I have to, maybe I can catch you."
He drew back a few paces and jumped so strongly that he almost took off the top of his head on the upper curve of the pipe. Frisky barked once, excitedly.
"Shut up, dog,"
Ben said. Naomi drew back to the edge of the moat, stood there for a moment. The snow had by then been coming down so heavily that Ben couldn't see her, and then ran forward. Ben held his breath, hoping she wouldn't misjudge the edge of the good ice. If she ran too far before making her leap, the longest arms in the world wouldn't catch her. But she timed it perfectly. Ben didn't need to catch her. All he had to do was to get out of her way as she carried into the pipe. She didn't even bump her head, as Ben had done.
"The worst part of it was the smell,"
Naomi said as they told their story to a wondering Dennis.
"How did you stand it?"
"Well, I just kept reminding myself of what would happen to me if I got caught," Dennis said. "Every time I did that, the air seemed to smell a little better."
Ben laughed at this and nodded, and Dennis looked at him with shining eyes for a moment. Then he looked back at Naomi.
"It did smell awfully bad, though," he agreed. "I remember that it smelled bad when I was a kid, but not that bad. Maybe a kid doesn't really know how bad a smell is, or something."
"I guess that could be,"
Naomi said. Frisky was lying on a pile of royal napkins with her muzzle on her paws, her eyes moving from one person to the next as each spoke. She knew very little of what they were saying, but if she had, and if she could have spoken, she would have told Dennis that his perceptions of what made a really bad smell hadn't changed at all since he was a boy. It had been the last dying remainder of the dragon sand they had smelled, of course. The odor had been much stronger to Frisky than to the girl and the tall boy. Dennis's scent had still been there, now mostly in splashes and blobs on the curved walls. These were the places Dennis had touched with his hands. The floor of the pipes was covered with a foul, warm water that had washed away all scent. It was the same bright electric blue. The other scent was a dull, leathery green. Frisky was afraid of it. She knew that some scents could kill, and she knew that not so long ago this had been just such a scent. But it was losing its potency now, and in any case, Dennis's scent led away from the greater concentrations of it. Not too long before they reached the grating Dennis had used to get out of the sewer system, she began to lose the green smell altogether, and Frisky was never in her whole life so happy to lose a smell.
"You met no one? No one at all?"
Dennis asked anxiously.
"No one," Ben said. "I ranged a little bit ahead to keep an eye out. I saw guards several times, but we always had plenty of time to get to some cover before they could see us. In truth, I think we could have come directly here and passed 20 guards and only have been challenged once or twice. Most of them were drunk."
Naomi nodded.
"Guards of the watch," she said. "Drunk! And not drunk out on picket along the northern borders of some pissy little barony no one ever heard of. Drunk in the castle! Right in the castle!"
Dennis, remembering the toneless, nose-blowing singer, nodded gloomily.
"I suppose we should be glad. If the guard of the watch was now what it was in Roland's day, we'd all be in the needle along with Peter. But I can't be glad somehow."
"I'll tell you this," Ben said in a soft voice. "If I were Thomas, I'd quake in my boots every time I looked north, if such as we saw tonight are all as he has around him."
Naomi looked very troubled at this.
"Pray the gods it never comes to that," she said.
Ben nodded. Dennis reached out and stroked Frisky's head.
"Followed me all the way from Paynes, did you? What a smart dog you are, eh?"
Frisky thumped her tail happily. Naomi said,
"I would hear this story of the sleepwalking king, Dennis, if you would tell it again."
So Dennis told his story, much as he told it to Pena and as I have told it to you, and they listened as spellbound as children hearing the tale of the talking wolf in the gammer's nightcap. 108. By the time he had finished, it was 7 o'clock. Outside, a dim gray glow had come over Delane. That clotted stormlight was as bright at 7 as it would be at noon, for the greatest storm of that winter, and perhaps the greatest in history, had come to Delane. The wind howled around the eaves of the castle like a tribe of banshees. Even down here, the fugitives could hear it. Frisky raised her head and whined uneasily.
"What do we do now?"
Dennis asked. Ben, who had gone over Peter's brief note again and again, said,
"Until tonight, nothing. The castle's awake by now, and there's no way we could get out of here without being seen under any circumstances. We sleep, get our strength back, and tonight, before midnight—"
Ben spoke briefly. Naomi grinned. Dennis's eyes grew bright with excitement.
"Yes," Dennis said. "By the gods, you're a genius, Ben." "Please, I wouldn't go that far," Naomi said,
but by then her grin was so broad it seemed in danger of splitting her head in two. She reached over, put her arms around Ben, and kissed him soundly. Ben turned an absolutely alarming shade of red. He looked as if he might be on the verge of bursting his brains, as they said in Delane in those long-ago days. I must tell you, though, that he also looked delighted.
"Will Frisky help us?" Ben asked when he got his breath back.
At the sound of her name, Frisky looked up again.
"Of course she will, but we'll need—"
They discussed this new plan for some time longer, and then Ben's lower face seemed to almost disappear in a great yawn. Naomi also looked tired out. They had been awake for over 24 hours by then, you will remember, and had come a great distance.
"Enough," Ben said. "It's time for sleep." "Hooray,"
Naomi said, beginning to arrange more napkins in a mattress for herself beside Frisky.
"My legs feel as if—"
Dennis cleared his throat politely.
"What is it?"
Ben asked. Dennis looked at their packs, Ben's big one, Naomi's slightly smaller one.
"I don't suppose you've got, anything to eat in there, do you?"
Impatiently, Naomi said,
"Of course we do. What do you think—"
Then she remembered that Dennis had left Payne's farmhouse 6 days ago, and that the butler had been skulking and hiding ever since. He had a pallid, undernourished look, and his face was too narrow and too bony.
"Oh, Dennis, I'm sorry, we're idiots. When did you eat last?"
Dennis thought about this.
"I can't remember exactly," he said,
but the last sit-down meal I had was my lunch a week ago.
Why didn't you say so first thing, you dolt? Ben exclaimed.
I guess because I was so excited to see you, Dennis said and grinned, as he watched the two of them open their packs and begin rooting through the remainder of their supplies. His stomach gurgled noisily, saliva squirted into his mouth, then a thought struck him.
You didn't bring any turnips, did you?
Naomi turned to look at him, puzzled.
Turnips? I don't have any, do you, Ben?
No.
A gentle and supremely happy smile spread across Dennis's face.
Good, he said.
109. That was a mighty storm indeed, and it's still told of in Delane today. 5 feet of new snow had fallen by the time an early, howling dark came down on the castle keep. 5 feet of new snow in one day is mighty enough, but the wind made drifts that were much, much bigger. By the time dark fell, the wind was no longer blowing a four-scale, it was blowing a hurricane. In places along the castle walls, snow was piled 25 feet deep and covered the windows of not just first and second floors, but the third-floor windows as well. You might think this would have been good for Peter's escape plans, and it might have been if the needle hadn't stood all alone in the plaza, but it did, and here the wind blew its hardest. A strong man couldn't have stood against that wind. He would have been sent rolling head over heels until he crashed against the first stone wall on the far side of the plaza. And the wind had another effect as well. It was like a giant broom. As fast as the snow fell, the wind blew it out of the plaza. By dark, there were huge drifts piled against the castle and clogging most of the alleys on the west side of the castle keep, but the plaza itself was clean as a whistle. There were only the frozen cobbles waiting to break Peter's bones if his rope should break. And I must tell you now that Peter's rope was bound to break. When he tested it, it had held his weight, but there was one fact about that mystic thing called breaking strain that Peter didn't know. Joseph hadn't known either. The ox drivers knew it, though, and if Peter had asked them, they would have told him an old axiom, one known to sailors, loggers, seamstresses, and anyone else who works with thread or rope. The longer the cord, the sooner the break. Peter's short test rope had held him. The rope to which he meant to entrust his life, the very thin rope, was about 265 feet long. It was bound to break, I tell you, and the cobbles below waited to catch him and break his bones and bleed away his life. 110. There were many disasters and near disasters on that long, stormy day, just as there were many acts of heroism, some successful and some doomed to failure. Some farmhouses in the inner baronies blew over, as the houses of the indolent pigs were blown over by the wolf's hungry breath in the old story. Some of those who were thus rendered homeless managed to work their way across the white wastes to the castle keep, roped together for safety. Others wandered off the Delane Great Road and into the whiteness where they were lost. Their frozen, wolf-gnawed bodies wouldn't be found until the spring. But by 7 that evening, the snow had finally begun to abate a little, and the wind to fall. The excitement was ending, and the castle went to bed early. There was little else to do. Fires were banked, children tucked in, last cups of field tea drunk, prayers said. One by one the lights went out. The crier called in his loudest voice, but the wind still tore his voice out of his mouth at 8 o'clock, and again at 9. It was not until 10 that he could be heard again, and by then most people were asleep. Thomas was also asleep, but his sleep was not easy. There was no Dennis to stay with him and comfort him this night. Dennis was still home ill. Thomas had thought several times of sending a page to check on him, or even to go himself. He liked Dennis very much, but something always seemed to come up. Papers to sign, petitions to hear, and, of course, bottles of wine to be drunk. Thomas hoped Flagg would come and give him a powder to help him sleep. But ever since Flagg's useless trip into the north, the magician had been strange and distant. It was as if Flagg knew there was something wrong but could not quite tell what it was. Thomas hoped the magician would come but hadn't dared to summon him. As always, the shrieking wind reminded Thomas of the night his father died, and he feared he would have a hard time getting to sleep, and that once he was asleep, horrible nightmares might come, dreams in which his father would scream and rant and finally burst into flames. So Thomas did what he had grown accustomed to doing. He spent the day with a glass of wine always in his hand, and if I told you how many bottles of wine this mere boy consumed before he finally went to bed at 10 o'clock, you probably wouldn't believe me, so I won't say, but it was a lot. Lying there miserably on his sofa, wishing that Dennis was in his accustomed place on the hearth, Thomas thought, "My head aches and my stomach feels sick. Is being king worth all this? I wonder." You might wonder, too, but before Thomas himself could wonder any more, he fell heavily asleep. He slept for almost an hour, and then he rose and walked. Out the door he went and down the halls, ghostly in his long white nightshirt. This night a late-going maid with an armload of sheets saw him, and he looked so much like old King Roland that the maid dropped her sheets and fled, screaming. Thomas's darkly dreaming mind heard her screams and thought they were his father's. He walked on, turning into the less-used corridor. He paused halfway down and pushed the secret stone. He went into the passageway, closed the door behind him, and walked to the end of the corridor. He pushed aside the panels which were behind Niner's glass eyes, and though he was still asleep, he pushed his face up to the holes, as if looking into his dead father's sitting room. And here we will leave the unfortunate boy for a while, with the smell of wine surrounding him and tears of regret running from his sleeping eyes and down his cheeks. He was sometimes a cruel boy, often a sad boy, this pretend king, and he had almost always been a weak boy. But even now I must tell you that I do not believe he was ever really a bad boy. If you hate him because of the things he did, and the things he allowed to be done, I will understand. But if you do not pity him a little as well, I will be surprised.